And that jarring cacophony tells you that, yet again, you're back with the Power of Three podcast. Today, as this episode drops, it's the 29th of April, 2024. And we're continuing our countdown to the launch of the new series of Doctor Who, Series 1, Series 14, whatever you want to call it. And we're going to be looking at a third Doctor book today, following on from our first two episodes of this run. And today, our third Doctor novel is The Sons of Caresh, which was the 55th novel in the BBC Past Doctor Adventures series. It was written by Paul Saint, released on the 5th of August 2002, and featured the third Doctor and Joe Grant. And this is probably the one that most people will remember as being the one where the Doctor and Joe get their heads shaved on the cover. Wonder what Christopher Eccleston would have to say about another Doctor with a closely cropped haircut like that. So let's hear what the back cover has to say. Joe gripped the sides of the console. Even over the roar of the engine, she could hear branches whipping and snapping against the TARDIS exterior. The view in the scanner was receding at the speed of an express train. It showed the swathe of destruction they were leaving behind them, a ragged police box-shaped tunnel through the forest. In England, a hotel worker has been turned to stone. An ancient lake has vanished, and an inmate of a mental hospital is being terrorised by unseen creatures. In Israel, in the shadow of Masada, an archaeological dig unearths something that should have stayed buried. The Doctor is sure he's dealing with a local and relatively straightforward temporal anomaly. Troy Gim, a refugee from the planet Caresh, is not so certain. She believes the impending destruction of her homeworld is somehow linked to the events on Earth, and she is pinning her hopes on the Doctor to avert the catastrophe. But can the Doctor interfere with a planet's destiny? And should he risk his newfound freedom to do it? This story features the third Doctor and Joe. So there we go, we've got the setup. So why don't we pop over to meet the author, Paul Saint.
Yes, hello Kenny. My name is Paul, full name Paul Beardsley. I also wrote under the pseudonym Paul Saint, Saint being my wife's maiden name. And I wrote The Sons of Caresh, which was a third Doctor novel. Prior to that, I'd written a brief encounter in Doctor Who magazine called In the Community. And that surprisingly seemed to be canonical later, as I gave a name to the girl who was the Black Dalek in Remembrance. Named her Judith Winters, and that seems to have caught on. And I also wrote a short story for Big Finish for the Christmas Treasury called The Little Things, and that was largely featured around the Shell Room in the TARDIS.
Interesting place to go and visit. So I'd imagine then that getting the commission to do The Sons of Caresh was something that you'd been, you know, keen to do, having had your brief encounter published and be keen to do a full-length Doctor Who novel. So was this your first pitch, or had you tried other ones previously to Justin or indeed to Virgin?
It was my first pitch. I'd been toying with the idea of doing one long before the classic series even ended. I just loved the idea of doing, well, a target-sized one, but an original story. And then I came up with all sorts of silly reasons why the ideas I had were not ready for submission. But eventually a friend of mine just said, just write it. And so I thought, yeah, why don't I? So I threw together this pitch, sent it off, a few months passed, and Justin got back to me. And I got a few changes I want you to make, but otherwise it's pretty good. So I thought, yeah, I'm okay with this.
Was it always planned as a third Doctor and Joe novel? Because I know that sometimes people would submit for one Doctor and Companion and then have to tweak it for another.
I'd had a vague idea of it being Seventh Doctor and Ace, then a vague idea of it being Eighth Doctor and can't remember who his companion, might have been Sam, but no firm ideas. I also had an idea of it being a doctor with a non-TV companion, but never got far with that. The John Pertwee doctor, he was the doctor when I was around the right age, about 10, and I'd watched a few Hartnells and Troughtons, but I was very young. Pertwee's I found absolutely terrifying, and I'd join in the adults saying this is rubbish, but it was only because I was so scared. I remember the troll doll in Terror of the Autons coming to life, and you know, that really freaked me out. And likewise, the policemen with the masks being ripped off, and suddenly the Doctor and Joe are trapped in a car with what? I didn't watch the whole thing, I just watched those bits, and I had no idea how it got resolved or anything. I was just too scared to watch it again.
I take it you have since watched it on iPlayer or VHS or DVD or Blu-ray.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I've watched every existing episode and I've listened to every audio episode. So I've kind of done the entire body of work.
Yeah, but that's good. I just wanted to make sure that you've got over that trauma.
I have, yes. Although, I think it was last year, I realised that when they knocked that Auton and he does a kind of cartwheel down the hill, and the stuntman actually sustains an injury, but nevertheless just immediately gets up as if to just brush himself off and carry on the pursuit.
Yep.
That's pretty scary to watch. I mean, not as in I'm scared, but it's objectively scary.
Yeah. Teddy Walsh. He was
Terry Walsh, yeah.
He was there, got back up and on he went. So what was your starting point for Sons? I'd imagine then that the Doctor and Joe are always a favourite of the Pertwee era viewers.
Yes. The starting point was actually, I'd been watching, I think it was Horizon or some other popular science programme, and it was about chaos theory. And they were showing how it would be possible to have possibly a double planet with a satellite that does a figure of eight orbit and unpredictably switches from one centre of mass to the other. I think it was planets, because I remember thinking at the time, well, that would work with suns, wouldn't it? Thinking about it, it's not a million miles from the three-body problem, although I think that's three suns. But nevertheless, I like the chaos idea, and I thought, yeah, that would be maybe a viable planet, but not necessarily a comfortable one. So straight away, the stories there, it would work best as a Doctor Who story, I felt.
And that's sort of where you introduce the character of Troy Game, who comes to Earth and very quickly becomes, for the start of the book, sort of the main character as we sort of follow her and watch her as she tries to adapt to life on Earth.
Yes. Troy Game, she did kind of become her own character in my mind. Characterization was one of my weakest areas as a writer at the time. So I was quite pleased, really, with Troy Game. Took me ages to come up with a name for her. I eventually found it, I think it was in Suetonius' Book of the 12 Caesars. And Troy Game is one of the things they do in the amphitheatres. And I just thought, that's a good name for somebody. She becomes temporarily telepathic, and I'll admit my inspiration there. That was very much influenced by a Robert Silverberg novel called Dying Inside, about a chap approaching middle age and finding that his incredible telepathic powers are just dying out. And it was like, so the reverse of everything else, where the power is growing and it becomes super. He's actually had his day, and it's how it's affected his life, and how is he going to cope once it's gone? So that was a major piece of inspiration.
I think that one of the clever things you did pretty quickly as well was to introduce a character who the Doctor Who fan readers would recognise in Simon Haldane, and of course his flat, which is known as Cloud Base, so nice little Captain Scarlet reference there. And I think I take it that was a deliberate thing to have somebody who's a sort of a sci-fi fan who's maybe slightly unlucky and not very good with the opposite gender, and just I could definitely at the time relate to him a bit. I could think of it as my younger self.
Yeah, as an element of my younger self, I mean, what he eventually did was obviously beyond the pale without giving too much away. But most of the time, he was just mostly well-meaning, a little bit naive. Yes, a bit my younger self. And I think he took science fiction terribly seriously. There is one moment where he lists some of the finest science fiction writers. And one of them's Ursula Le Guin, one of them's Gene Wolfe, and I think Greg Egan. But then he mentions David Langford. And I knew that David Langford would find out about it and mention it in his Ansible column. So I thought, that'll get a bit of interest in the book and maybe increase sales. And it appears to have actually worked. So once in a while, I can be Machiavellian and succeed at it. Most of the time, I fail dismally, of course.
I like it. Of course, we also have, lurking in the background, at least initially, Lady Salenti and Lord Rosh, the Time Lord's characters, with the Doctor sort of being put on a mission unofficially by Lady Salenti and Lord Rosh. There's a lot more to him than perhaps initially meets the eye.
I'd like to think so. I must admit, initially, I wanted a regeneration. And I thought, obviously, I can't regenerate the Doctor. Although, I mean, I didn't know what Lawrence Miles was going to do later, or earlier, I can't remember which. But I wanted a regeneration, and so I had my own Time Lord and thought, yeah, I can do what I like with that. Salenti was slightly based on a former girlfriend of mine who was actually blind. She didn't have a guide dog at the time, let alone one that was telepathic. I just like the idea of her continuing her interest in astronomy even when she couldn't see any of what was going on. And also, I like the idea of a blind character who doesn't turn out to, A, have superpowers that we'd like to think blind people have, but they don't. And B, she doesn't turn out to be not blind after all, surprise. As I felt that was an overworked and quite distasteful cliche, so I thought I'd get around that.
We also get to meet a character at the start of the book who, of course, there's a little bit of timey-wiminess, as we would now call it, going on with Ezekiel Child.
Yes. In some ways, I thought he was simply serving a plot point, but on reflection, I did actually quite like him as a character. I liked an archaeologist who failed through no fault of his own, who had an inner life. So, yeah, that's probably all I can really say about him, but the fact that, as I say, at the time, characterization was not my strong point, I was happy with what I did with him. I don't know what other people thought, but one of the criticisms was that we find out we get happy endings for characters that we haven't really come to care about, whereas certain other ones that we did care about are dismissed in a single paragraph.
That's interesting. We'll come to that further down the line. Now, the story setting, of course, is that we're in pretty much the present day, because I know that initially you would expect it being a Third Doctor story, you'd expect it to be in the era in which the UNIT adventures are set, so that I'm not nailing it down to the 70s or 80s there. Leave that for others to worry about UNIT dating. The fact it was a more contemporary setting, the fact that there's mentions of things like mobile phones, there's emails, things like that, and you know, very much it was in the contemporary world. So how did you find bringing the Third Doctor and Joe into that?
Yeah, interesting point. I think I was partly inspired by a big Finnish play, The Marion Conspiracy. The great thing about that is that the Doctor and Evelyn got into trouble because they were like a year out. Had they been, you know, 20 or 30 years out, it wouldn't have been so bad, but it was just not the right time to talk about Elizabeth, if I'm getting the details right. So I was thinking, having them travel less than 30 years, spoiler, I do actually nail down the UNIT dating, I actually quite like the idea of the small changes over a small period of time, but nevertheless, quite a few things that are unrecognizable. I thought that was potentially more interesting than, say, setting it 1,000 years in the future. So much was unchanged, but you just get little details. Like, I was quite proud of my description where Joe observes that there are radio telescopes on the sides of people's houses, because that's how it probably would have looked at, like, to her. So I think it was more in the uncanny valley than it would have been if it had been 1 year or 1,000 years.
I also enjoyed something that in some ways almost preempted something that we got in The Runaway Bride, with the TARDIS going through streets and crashing and before finally coming to a halt. And it felt very Russell T. Davis to me, that just where it's got to where it's been plugged into with Lady Salenti's device, and it's sort of crash landing, but it's constantly on the move, which I really enjoyed, and it was great to visualise that.
Talking of The Runaway Bride, I was delighted that in a discussion group after The Runaway Bride had come out, somebody said it was reminiscent of The Sons of Keresh. And I thought, yes!
Take that as a win.
Definitely.
Yeah. Then, of course, we get Joe meeting up with Troy Game, and they meet, and they have such a... It's a nice partnership that they get, and obviously with Troy Game being slightly disturbed by the visions that she's been having. So it's quite a nice partnership. There's that element of distrust, but they work through it and they do make quite a good double act.
Glad you think so. I'm certainly aiming for that.
Well, that's good. I'm glad.
Because they did go exploring together, didn't they, at one point? Yes. Yes, it's all of a day since I last reread it.
Something that also stuck in the mind, this talking of TARDISes and imagery, was the Lord Roche's TARDIS and the fact that it's been flooded and everything that's gone inside from the river and inside this TARDIS. And then, of course, we find it's being guarded by, I suppose it'd be fair to say, there's a bit of weeping angels, a bit of silence in there.
Oh, definitely silence. Yes, when the silence first appeared on TV, I thought, yeah, that's a nice idea. I don't for a second think that Stephen Moffat had necessarily read Sons of Keresh. I mean, my thought at the time was all these aliens that people don't remember. I thought, how about an alien that you don't remember? So that was the thinking behind the Furies. And yeah, now that you mentioned it, there is a bit of Weeping Angel, isn't there? I hadn't thought of that at all. What they do to people.
Yeah, sort of. Okay, they're not sending them back in time. They're aging them and turning them into statues. So, yeah, there's that element of the way that angels can do that as well. So, yeah, that which beholds an angel becomes an angel. So, yeah, it's all in there. There's definite similarities. So, yeah. Mm. Dear Mr. Moffat, here's my legal letter. I joke. Then, of course, we get all the action on Earth that once they've sorted things out there, and off we go to Keresh. So how was it creating your own world? And it's fascinating to sort of being an ocean world, but say the inhabitants don't have earlobes and they all have their hair shorn. And of course, this is the point at which the cover image is created, with that memorable image of John Pertwee and Katie Manning with her head shaved.
Yeah, I remember suggesting that, thinking, hey, that could work. And that was very badly received in some quarters. And they felt it was disrespectful to John Pertwee. He had died by that point, as I recall. And so there was some anger there. It just never occurred to me. I thought, in the book, he had a buzz cut, so why wouldn't he on the cover? So, yeah, no offence intended. I have to admit, I think if I had my time again, it would have been better. There was an element at the time, I wanted more off-Earth stories. I really do like to see the TARDIS on other planets. I tend to think it just lands on Earth too often. to the extent that there's probably more multi-doctor stories than there are stories set on well-realized planets. So the original pitch for Sons of Karesh, there was a lot more off-world. And Justin felt that because it was a Third Doctor book, it would work better as an Earth-based book. So to an extent, I was clawing back the off-world stuff. Part of my approach was, when Troy Game is looking around Chichester and not understanding much, instead of simply having a, I don't know what a traffic light is, I don't know what a bicycle is, I was trying to convey some of what it was like on Karesh in comparison. Things like she sees a pregnant woman and think, how could she be pregnant this time of year? And sort of think to that effect. I think because it was a bit clawed back, I didn't go as all out in the imagining of the actual planet. I do actually have plans for a revisit of Karesh, not necessarily in a Doctor Who context, and I would try and be a bit more visual and imaginative if that were to come about.
Interesting. Stay tuned, as John Nathan Turner used to tell us. So how did you find writing for The Doctor and Joe?
I did watch a lot of videos, had to borrow VHSs of The Doctor. I couldn't get many with Joe, so I ended up doing some with Sarah, like Death to the Daleks. And I was playing it, writing down what the Doctor said, pausing it, playing it again, and writing down a bit more, and speaking it out loud. And rereading it this week, I was surprised at how much I could hear the John Pertwee Doctor speaking. Joe, to an extent, I think she was possibly less fully realised than the Doctor, even on TV. Nevertheless, I sort of thought, yes, I can believe this is Joe.
I definitely read them very much as characters, particularly when the Doctor's getting his slightly more grumpy side and taking it out in Joe and then pulls himself back. So it definitely worked that for me. And of course, talking of John Pertwee, Lord Rosh regenerates into him, so it's finally a chance for two-third Doctors, a doppelganger story. The First Doctor had the massacre, the Second Doctor, of course, had Enemy of the World, so finally the Third Doctor gets his doppelganger.
Of course, he's the only one who didn't, really. The reason I didn't realise that was I remember there was a comic strip where the Doctor and Joe accidentally jump a time track, and it turns out that there's a Doctor and Joe running around robbing banks, which, you know, most parallel worlds are going to have an evil version of you, even if you're not even from the planet. But as a result, I was aware of two Doctors. Plus, of course, in Day of the Daleks, where they briefly meet themselves.
Yeah.
But an actual full-on doppelganger. There were some things I just didn't think I'd get away with. The crash-landing TARDIS, for one. Lord Rosh remaining in the appearance of John Pertwee at the end. And the cover, for all that, I didn't anticipate the backlash.
I think that it comes to the conclusion it's not what I was expecting, because, you know, just rereading it, I'm good with remembering lots of details. Don't always remember every last one. So I enjoyed the resolution and how Karesh is sorted out and is able to continue. But it does have that, how the heck are they going to get out of this one kind of feel to it.
That's really good to hear. Yeah. I mean, there was a bit where, you know, they passed the deadline and the Doctor is like, look, we have passed the deadline. There isn't anything else we can do. And I'm delighted that it worked for you anyway. I'm hoping it worked for lots of people. I do remember a review saying that the solution was actually playing fair with the reader. It wasn't just a sort of an ass pull. So, yeah, great to hear that.
Ooh. And, of course, the ending, which we discussed before we started briefly, it's ambiguous with Troy Yame. Is she alive or is she not? As she's gone out to sea and she's enjoying being back in the waters of her own world. She's under the water and she's virtually out of air, but she's quite happy to stay under.
Yes. I don't know what really happened there. I certainly didn't originally intend her to be deliberately drowning herself, but one person who'd read it had said to me that he was annoyed that he said, your characters always die at the end. And I thought, well, Troy Game didn't. And then reading it recently, I thought, I can see how he read it. I can see how he read it that way. Another review I read talked about her becoming a sea creature. And the way the reviewer wrote it, it was very much as if the book was magical realism. And I thought, I kind of like this. Something like Gabriel García Márquez. I thought, yeah, I'll take that.
That's fascinating. I never read it in that way at all. I read it as a good science fiction story, but not magical realism. That's very interesting. Just, it's amazing how people can interpret the same piece of work in so many ways. But then again, that way lies academic papers.
Just, I can't imagine an academic paper on the Sons of Keresh. Well, I'd be delighted, but...
So, I mean, so all in all, was it quite a happy experience for you going through the writing? I'd imagine that everybody always says how great Justin is to work with, so I imagine that it'd been the same for you.
Yeah, very much. I think if I remember rightly, it was like a provisional acceptance. And I thought, well, I'm just going to write it for the fun of it. And then when he found out how much I'd written already, he was kind of, wow, you're going to be easy to work with. And I thought, yeah, that's fine by me. It was to the effect of someone who's actually ahead of schedule. So, yes, he had a few suggested changes, all of them pretty reasonable. There was just one really trivial one that I thought, why did I have to lose that bit? And it was the part where the doctor is rescued from freezing water. He's pulled onto a dinghy, and it's Solenti and her guide dog. And it's just this point where the doctor is almost lost consciousness, and it just says he smelled dog. And Justin insisted on changing it to something like he smelled wet fur or something. And I thought, I like he smelled dog, but fair enough.
Well, he's the boss. We'll let him away with it.
Yes.
He knows what he's doing. Now, of course, this was your only Doctor Who novel credit. Now, do I remember correctly in saying that you had an idea for an eighth Doctor novel that I seem to vaguely remember reading this on the BBC website? Am I correct or am I completely making this up?
I did have an idea for a sequel. And again, I wasn't sure. I was flitting about between the eighth Doctor and others. I'd finally settled on the fourth Doctor and Sarah Jane, and it'd be set on the planet, the same planet, but the other continent, which is hinted at briefly at the end of The Sons of Keresh. The continent Faon, and the Faoni, as they're called, they don't know about the archipelago, just as most people on the archipelago don't know about the continent. And they haven't travelled that far yet, and it's a big planet. So I had got as far as writing a complete proposal for it, over 4,000 words synopsis, and I think I did 4,000 words of chapter as well. My problem was there was a lot of information to convey, and it was hard to do it in the word count. And Justin had actually said, do it as an appendix if you want. So I did. And he was sort of saying it's a great science fiction story, but not a great Doctor Who story. And then I thought, I just need to convince him that the Doctor is the central character doing all the things that need doing. And that's when the new TV series was announced, and so all the books were cancelled. But I did come up with an alternative plan for it. For a long time, I thought so much of it is steeped in Doctor Who lore that it can only work as a Doctor Who novel. But then I thought, what if I reimagined most of the lore as something else? And so I've actually started, I'm on my first draft of Blood of the Faeoni, as it was always going to be called. There'll be a few little changes. Solenti's in it, but under her original name, Sulenti. There's a reason it changed from Sulenti to Solenti. I'm probably giving too much information when I say it's to do with one of my wife's cuddly penguins.
That's okay. Okay, I'll let that one go. I'll let that go. We'll leave that just to hang there in the mind, to wonder what on earth is happening next. So, after Sins of Corrosion, obviously, sadly, this one, the sequel didn't emerge. What else have you been writing before we talk about Strange Doorways?
I was just doing bits and pieces. I think around about that time, I decided to get a career, change career to teaching, and that took up so much of my time that I had very little time to actually write. I got the Big Finish short story that I mentioned, the Little Things, and one or two short science fiction stories in small press magazines. But I'd had this idea knocking about of what became Strange Doorways. I've often thought, what's behind that door? Sometimes you see doorways that probably shouldn't really be where they are, or you never see anyone come through them. And I thought, what if it connects with parallel worlds or something like that? What if it just leads to infinite corridors, successions of rooms, and there's a sense of they've been recently abandoned? What happens if they're inhabited by whatever the denizens are, who are not quite human? What if other people stumbled upon them again as well? So that's the kind of idea I'd got. So I needed a reason to explore them other than mere exploration. So I've got the character Philip. He has a brief encounter with one of the corridors behind a door that's kind of hidden, and he's fairly sure it's a real experience. It really does lead to some distortion of our world, maybe a parallel world, maybe something not so straightforward, but he has no reason to explore it further. And like 10 years pass, by which time he's trapped in a loveless marriage, and he has a daughter who he does adore, and then when she goes missing in impossible circumstances, he starts to wonder, does he actually know where she's really gone? So that's the basic premise.
Fantastic. And of course, it's been released through Nielsen
Productions. That's right, yes.
From Stuart Mitchell. So how did that all come about?
Well, that was a stroke of improbable luck. I had originally self-published it, but I hadn't got a clue about publicity or how to do a decent cover and things like that. I had got to know Joe, half of Neosum, just by a chance meeting on a train once, back in 2008. She's probably the second singer I got chatting to on a train. The other one was a lady called Helen, who had her own TV show in Italy when she was younger.
Mad world.
Yeah. I'm not even that sociable. I'm the kind of person who'll sit on a train with a book in front of me and not looking at anyone. But when I do talk to people, they end up to be talented singers.
The best I can do for a meeting somebody in a train was Gareth Thomas.
Oh, wow. We're talking Blake here.
We are indeed talking Blake. Yep, not the rugby player.
That's pretty cool. More cool than the rugby player, I would reckon.
I agree.
Yeah. A friend of mine who knew I was a big fan of Goodnight Sweetheart, she was sitting on a train, and opposite her was a woman that she eventually said, "Excuse me, I can't help noticing you look like Dervla Kerwin." And the woman said, "Well, yes, I am her." And so this friend of mine was thinking, I can't wait to tell Paul Beardsley. And in fact, they got on very well. And I don't know if they stayed in touch. I'll have to ask her.
That is cool. So yeah, it's now available as you can get a signed edition directly from www.neosome.com. That's neosome.com. So it's quite, I'd imagine it's quite an exciting time for you then, just having a new book out. It's always that sort of rush and hoping that people enjoy it and the copies go off the shelf. Or the
absolutely. And I mean, the cover looks fantastic. I saw the front, the spine, the back, and I just thought, wow. Thought, if that doesn't sell copies, I don't know what will. Especially as my original one was just a picture of Whitby Abbey, which, you know, it looked okay, but it was just a photograph I'd taken on holiday. So, hope I'm not giving away too much. The Slither Man on the cover, I think, is arresting. And I hope people think, I want to know more about this.
So we can look forward to seeing Stephen Moffat ripping him off before too long in the next series of Doctor Who.
We can hope, yes.
Fantastic. Well, Paul, thank you so much for taking the time to have a chat and having a wee trip back to 2002 and the Sons of Koresh.
Thank you very much for having me on board, Kenny. I've really enjoyed it.
A huge thanks to Paul for his time there. And as we just said, you can get his new book, Strange Doorways, on Amazon, and there's the special signed edition from www.neosome.com. That's neosome.com. So, let's have a quick look back in the archives to find out what Doctor Who magazine had to say about the Sons of Koresh. This is from issue 323, which is the controversial one, with the Vervoids in the cover, which W.H. Smith thought looked a bit rude. So here's what the review by Vanessa Bishop had to say. The Sons of Koresh shines. It's intelligent, yet still colourfully loopy. It's like a Planet of the Spiders, with all the same old fun and action, but where we really get inside Mike Gates' head and discover why he feels at odds with the world. Like other recent Third Doctor novels, it can't resist a joke at Pertwee's expense, rewording his Green Cross Code mantra for a car journey. If it's a flashing amber and there are no pedestrians, you have right of way. Its weakness is a tendency to drop characters and plot lines, or that it chooses to run with the wrong ones. Killing off Simon is a mistake, so is returning to an earlier Doctor doppelganger at the end. It's funny on Earth, playing on descriptive humour rather than any possible mix-up. But the final doubt cast over the Doctor's identity appears tagged on just for the sake of some last-minute tension. It might work for Joe and Troy Game, but not for the reader, who knows that the imposter isn't even on the same planet. But these are minor criticisms compared to the sheer entertainment the novel provides. So there we go. So that's us. That's our third episode down. We'll be back tomorrow with a fourth Doctor adventure. As always, we like to play out with a tune, and today seems very appropriate, given that there's going to be an awful lot of light around if there's two suns orbiting you. So we're going to go with Walking in Sunshine by Katrina and the Waves, which is also slightly appropriate given they were a Eurovision act, and Eurovision's very close to now. Bye-bye.